Recording excerpted.
On to item 4A, a presentation from Veris on our total portfolio performance for the period ending June 30th, 2019.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, Candace, trustee Gordon has arrived.
Thank you, Jerry.
It's about time.
I didn't say that, did I? I mean, it's 6 o'clock in the morning there, and she was able to make it.
Yeah. I was able to make it.
It's a long story.
Spare us.
Yes. Who is?
You have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your materials, you have the second quarter investment performance review. And I'm going to begin after tab one on page 7. I can breathe a sigh of relief. I'm not going through every page in this book. But the first page, 7, is a summary of the key economic indicators as of the end of the second quarter. And when we think about capital markets and drivers of capital markets, returns and risk, the two primary drivers from an economic factor perspective are GDP and inflation. So when we talk to clients about different environments in which we expect assets to perform in, generally we're talking about those two quadrants, if you will, of growth or GDP and inflation, which affects more of the income-oriented assets. So at the time of this report, we did not have the second quarter GDP. That was actually just announced a couple weeks ago. But as of the first quarter, GDP was 3.2%, which is considered to be moderate growth. Unfortunately, the second quarter came in at 2.1%, so quite a bit lower. And a lot, I think, has changed globally, and we'll talk about some of those things as we progress. So at least as of the time of this report, we had a modest growth expectation. It was an improvement from the prior year, but since it's pulled back somewhat. Inflation, as you know, is targeted by the Fed at 2%, and so the actual rate of inflation as of the end of the second quarter was 2.1%, which isn't really a meaningful change from a year ago. So our central bank now for a while has shown itself to be skillful in maintaining a rate of inflation within a narrow range, and it has fluctuated anywhere between 1.7% and 2.2-2.3% really over much of the last decade or more. Other variables that we look at are unemployment rate, for instance. So the labor market continued to show strength during the second quarter. In fact, you can see that the official unemployment rate, which is the U3 unemployment, actually declined somewhat to 3.7%. So as you may be aware, this is something like a 60-year historic low for full employment. So all of these indicators, if we just were back at the end of June, would have portended to reasonable expectations for the remainder of the year, right? But things, as we know, have a way of changing. In fact, if you jump up to slide 14, you'll see here in the context of those two very important economic drivers, GDP and inflation, how the U.S. then compares to other regions around the world. And then when you look at these other regions, you can see exactly why the winds have changed somewhat in terms of expectations for the U.S. economy. The Eurozone at the end of the second quarter had pretty weak both GDP and inflation numbers, and much higher unemployment at 7.5%, so essentially double the unemployment rate of the U.S. Japan, the story seems to be frozen in decades now of having pretty much zero growth, zero inflation, and pretty low unemployment. The interesting countries to me are the BRICS, so the emerging markets countries of Brazil, Russia, India, and China. You can see the growth rates have really come down. In fact, Brazil and Russia had lower economic growth expectation than the U.S. and both higher inflation and higher unemployment relative to the U.S. And then in India and China, which really have been the leading generators of growth with much higher GDP, their respective GDPs are still high, and we would probably kill for a 6% GDP rate, but certainly that is moderated quite a bit from a couple of years ago for China. And interestingly, the unemployment numbers in those two countries have gone up. Yes.
Question on the China data, is that state reported data or is that independently derived?
Well, these numbers are generally generated by the central bank of or the whatever the government economic apparatus is. So yes, those come from the government.
So I should believe that China had 6.4% growth rate. Yeah.
You should assign a high degree of credibility to that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what I meant to say, Gary. Thank you.
Or not.
Yep.
Go ahead, Dave.
Oh, I was just going to say on 14 versus the chart on 7, inflation 2.1 there and then 1.6. Are those different inflation calculations or? Here it says CPI year over year. Is there a significance why those are?
That is a good question. They should be the same. So let me look into that.
Eileen, I can ask color.
Yes,
Tom. One of those measures is the quarterly number, which is a quarterly breakdown, and then one is the annual. So one issue is the difference between annualized GDP and quarter over quarter GDP.
Yeah.
Two differences.
CPI year over year.
So the first one would be the quarter and the second one would be the annual?
I don't have that deck in front of me, but one should be a quarterly breakdown with the components, which is the quarterly breakdown, and then one is the quarterly year over year.
They both say year over year, so I think they're both supposed to be the same.
So one's core, not
David's question sort of leads into my 30,000 foot reaction, and Ed got beaten up on this from time to time as well. Inflation is ties to inflation, and of course, living in the Bay Area skews many of our views of rent and housing costs. But everything I see in a real world sense, whether it's restaurants or gasoline or rent or housing costs, it is dramatically inflated. Is dramatically higher. No question electronics are cheaper, okay? But most of the aspects of everyday living are higher. As an aside, we accept the fact, or at least the newspapers recognize the fact, that we have mass numbers of people who can no longer afford to live here. And yet we talk about inflation as being almost non-existent. We're talking about rates of return on the 10-year and the 30-year that are to me just unbelievable that buyers would accept those numbers tied to an inflation rate. Obviously, it's got to be less than that. We're talking about something like 2% now on 30-year and what 1.5 on 10-year. It's just mind-boggling to me. Can you connect the dots at all on the difference between the numbers we see in these reports and what you see in everyday life?
So I'll make a couple comments, and then I will defer to my colleague, Thomas, who's part of our investment research or capital markets research group. But so one observation I would make that it wasn't that long ago, maybe 5 years ago, where inflation was actually hovering at 1% or even lower than 1%. So yes, you're right. Inflation has increased a lot in recent years, but it came from a very low level of literally hardly any inflation. It was 1% or lower for obviously as a result of the global financial crisis. So yes. Another observation is there are different inflation rates for different regions of the country, and it all kind of, when everything is put together, all of the components that derive our CPI, it's from a national perspective. So while things may seem, I even saw this number recently, and I don't know if Thomas knows, but I think inflation in California is something more on the order of like 3% or more than 3%. This is balanced out by other areas of the country that have, a lot of areas in the country that have much lower housing costs, lower gasoline prices. Our gas prices are in a class by themselves relative to the rest of the country. So when you take everything into account nationally, that's why the number is what it is. And that's the level at which the Fed is looking at it when they're levers to pull and what components worry them or don't worry them. And I don't know if you have anything to add, Thomas.
Yeah, those are some, it's a great question and great points. And I am coming here from Seattle, so I understand the rising cost of living. It doesn't seem like it's in line with that 1.9 or 2% inflation number. And absolutely part of it is because it's a national index, just like measuring cost of housing. It's hard to do that at a local level because at a local level, it's much different than the national average, but there are some funky things that go on with the calculation of CPI that go on with that inflation calculation. One of those is that housing prices float are in the inflation calculation. Housing prices are actually the rent equivalent. So the way that the cost of housing is measured is what it costs to rent. And rents, if rents aren't rising as much as housing, then that might be lower than we would think about when we think of how much houses have gone up in value. Another aspect of the calculation is it's called a hedonic adjuster, I believe. So what the CPI print does is it doesn't look at the total cost of the item necessarily. It takes into account TVs, for example. TVs might be more expensive than 10 years ago, but if the TVs are much more complex and sophisticated, then it'll automatically try to dampen that rise in cost, which kind of offsets. So there's some funkiness that goes on with that calculation.
Maybe the broader sort of question to both of you is, are they accurate measurements?
Sorry, was it?
Are these national numbers we're looking at accurate? Is the market basket being used and the adjustments being made for qualitative improvements and the recognition of what you would pay to rent that residential property that you're buying? Is that an accurate measure? It just doesn't feel that way to me. That's, I guess, the basic question. And I ask the people that really deal in this every day.
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's different definitions. There's CPI. There's CPI excluding food and energy. There's right. PCE. There are these different inflation definitions. And different definitions are used for different things like Social Security, welfare payments. And it kind of comes down to whether you agree with how each of those inflation metrics are built. If you agree with how they're defined, then it is what it is. But a lot of them have some nuances that are easy to disagree with. So it's a tough question to answer.
But we rely on the most widely cited, which is the core inflation, which does take into account the majority of the goods and services. I think it excludes cyclical things, but it takes into account the majority of the goods and services that our economy generates.
And the ongoing effect is that this inflation is divided into two parts, services and goods. And the prices of goods have been going down pretty subtly over time, so deflation, but the prices of services like education and healthcare have been going up. So the two offset each other, which is how the inflation number is arrived at. But goods have been going down in price, and that's offset some of these things that seem like inflation should be higher, like the cost of education or healthcare or housing. So there's kind of an offsetting effect.
That's a very helpful right there description. Thank you.
Yes.
So this morning, there's a report that Boris Johnson wants to suspend Parliament and push the UK towards a hard Brexit. Any idea? I mean, this will go into the currency discussion, I guess, we're having later on this morning. But so the pound is down and so forth. But any thoughts about how that might impact things on the international level? Or is this something you've been expecting, especially since Boris was put into?
Well, so what report... I'm a huge NPR junkie. So this morning, what I heard was this may be a tactic that he's been visiting the leaders in France and in Brussels of the EU and has had discussions with them. And the theory is that he may be... he's not trying to circumvent Parliament. What he's trying to prevent is what has been happening over the last couple of years in Parliament, and that is that they just argue and argue and argue and argue and don't get anywhere. He wants, the theory is that he's going to come with a deal, that he's been working behind the scenes with a deal, and he's giving them no time, so that essentially they're going to have to just cut to the chase and vote on something that hopefully avoids just Brexit, but we all know that he's okay with that as well. But I think he wants to be in a position to say, see, I got a deal, and you know, you either gave it thumbs up or thumbs down, and it's in your camp, not mine, when elections come up. So I think, you know, with that kind of information out there, I don't expect, other than obviously what we saw with the British pound, I don't expect there to be global ramifications or implications manifest until the point comes to I think it's October 31st, when they actually have to have their vote.
Okay. So I read his letter this morning to Parliament. It was kind of difficult to decipher it, because if you don't know all of the jargon or the process, it doesn't always make sense to us. But it sounds like he was trying to, it's like almost like calling a timeout, saying rather than have another 2 months of negative free-for-all and mishmash, and the letter refers to the rigorous debate in the House, that it's essentially a pause and a timeout and a time, but also a time to, I think, shore up, at least in his mind, the public's perception of how well off Britain actually is, sort of be able to do a little self-selling, if you will, before that deal comes, that whatever he's negotiating, he brings. So that if the choice set is the Brexit deal or no deal, the no deal scenario ain't so bad. That's what I took away from the letter. He wants time to make the case that we're going to be all right, without the harangue and the craziness. Anyway, it's worth it. It's available online. You can read the letter. But
well, he's a very skillful politician. So I don't know. I certainly wouldn't. I wouldn't dismiss what he's doing with respect to asking for Parliament to cease.
Yeah, you shouldn't judge him on his looks. Let's put it that way. Agreed.
You don't like his haircut?
I want to get him a comb. That's the only thing. Okay.
Any other questions? Shall I continue?
Please. Okay.
Good debate. I like this. So from 14, if we could jump up to slide 18. Another important economic indicator that investors pay a lot of attention to is obviously the interest rate environment, because that has an effect obviously on the ability of businesses to appropriately finance their business activities or conduct R&D and so forth. And at least at this point in time, at the end of the second quarter, the Fed had broadcast that it was not going to make any interest rate changes, but we know that since then, in July, the Fed actually did cut rates 25 basis points, and there is an expectation that they'll be cut again another 25 basis points between now and the end of the year. And you can see, again, it's the U.S. short-term and 10-year measures, which at this point, there was a slight inversion, right? Just very slightly higher short-term rates and 10-year rates. And that one indicator is probably the one cautionary forecast, if you will, for the U.S., because historically, when short-term rates have been at or higher than long-term rates, that's portentous of recession. And so I think that has abated somewhat, but the yield curve is very, very flat. And what that means is, investors are not incentivized to take that long-term risk relative to short-term issues because they're not going to be compensated from a yield perspective. But when you look at the rest of the world, we look pretty good because in the Eurozone, the short-term and some of the long-term rates are actually negative, and they've gotten more negative since this end of this quarter. Greece and UK being exceptions, but Japan also having negative rates. And then, obviously the three emerging markets countries of China, Brazil, and Russia, those are the places that have pretty high yields, and we've seen a fair amount of flow of capital into those bond markets, obviously, to benefit from those higher yields. So if we go from page 18 to 22.
Would you mind going back just a little bit? On 16.
Okay.
It's interesting to I wonder what your feelings are about the calls for recession. It's almost a call for recession. If you listen to the media talking heads, they're almost in groupthink. It's almost it's a herd mentality that basically says there's a recession coming. Mm-hmm. And I'm almost of the belief that it's easier to say there's a recession coming, which will certainly be true at some point, than to say there's not. Because it's easier for them to apologize later on for saying I missed the date instead of I missed the whole event. So it's almost as if it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You've got people out there that are just begging for a recession, and some that are outwardly and at least honestly begging for one because they think it will be bad for the Republican administration if we have one. But it's the talking heads herd mentality, which I wonder whether or not we should place much credibility on that, or it's going to happen, so fine, you can predict it. There is going to be an end of the world. I'll be happy to predict that. I just can't tell you when.
So interesting point, because I think the my perception is the media is putting a negative narrative out there specifically for political purposes. Mainstream media just hates this administration. And I don't know if you saw, I was in the Wall Street Journal either today or yesterday, a former Fed governor was actually encouraging the current Fed to act in contrary to the administration, basically to torpedo what they consider is bad decision making. Unfortunately, a lot of folks don't have their fingers on the pulse and aren't paying as close attention to markets and maybe multiple sources, and they're buying that narrative. I think, those of you in this room, because of your association with a large investment fund and, access to a lot of materials that economic materials and industry-generated materials probably see that, yes, we all recognize a recession happens once every, 7 to 8 years, usually historically, and we're certainly overdue for one, but the fundamentals are pretty good in this country, and, certainly we're long in the tooth of the credit markets, which is, one of the comments I was going to make on slide 22, but there's still very, very low unemployment. There is meaningful, wage growth beginning finally after many years of waiting for wages to increase, And, you know, we have a very strong economy in that we're not really export or import dependent, perhaps as much as some other countries where that is a factor for, like Germany, for instance. So.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know if you have anything.
Yeah, I guess on an ongoing basis, for the last 5 or 6 years, market experts and pundits have been saying we're 2 years away from a recession, right? So that's an ongoing thing that you don't get noticed, you don't get clicks or viewers by saying everything's great. You gloom and doom sells. So that's kind of an ongoing effect. I agree. It's been politicized. We've seen a sharp move towards everyone saying we're about to go into a recession without the economic fundamentals really moving enough to seemingly justify that claim. There have been some weaknesses, like in PMIs, as we showed on that slide, some weaknesses around the U.S., but we're a relatively strong economy looking at almost anywhere else in the developed world.
Thank you. The plane landed safely is not front page.
No.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
So is it fair to say then that your firm view is that there's no particular point of concern over kind of a given time frame that maybe you want to talk about? Well, is there anything we should be worried about?
Yeah, so if you actually turn to slide 22, we actually say that we do have some concern over the late cycle in credit markets, and that we don't believe that investors are being adequately compensated for credit risk. So we do think that there is some risk in the economy, in particular in that sort of below investment grade bank loans. Have been experiencing redemptions for almost a year now. Capital has been flowing out of them, mostly because, you know, rates were going up and now they're going down. And one of the attractive features of bank loans is with their adjustable rates. If there's an expectation of inflation, that's a pretty decent place to put your capital, right? Because the rates will reset at the higher rates of inflation, and the opposite has happened. And then we've also seen credit spreads really narrow in the high yield space. And we know that there's been a tremendous amount of triple B issuance, that market segment, which is the lowest investment grade market segment. It just really burgeoned over the last couple of years, and there is fear that there's kind of a bubble in that space, and those companies are all at risk of teetering into below investment grade. So there is some element of risk related to credit, not unlike what we saw potentially, maybe not as great as 2007, which was the last kind of credit event with the subprime, but there could be some correction. Again, I don't know, Thomas, this market segment.
So our view that the U.S. economy doesn't look like it's going into recession yet doesn't mean that we don't have fear of the capital markets, because the capital markets and the economy are not always linked. So looking at the capital markets, our fear is more around recession in Europe, credit problems. I guess our main fear regarding U.S. assets is, at this point, is that if the world starts to move into recession, even if the U.S., you know, remains at 1.9%, 1.7% GDP growth, that the world moving weaker could still have a large negative impact on portfolios. So the U.S. economy is only one part of our overall investment views at this point, and it does around the world look like we are going through a slowdown, and we've been going through a slowing down for about 18 months. Looks like Germany is probably in recession at this point. We could see Italy. We could see a lot of problems bubbling up in Europe. It's unclear where Japan is going. Their quantitative easing isn't really done what it's supposed to. So there's a lot of problems around the world, but the U.S. remains a bright spot. Although the U.S. assets are priced appropriately for the U.S. being a bright spot, maybe even higher. So there are considerations in the capital markets that are kind of outside that U.S. economic story.
Do you see any issues with the current tariff battles between the U.S. and China, and how that impacts our economy.
Well, there's definitely been negative impacts on certain sectors of the economy, and you know, the recent rhetoric from the Chinese is to kind of go for the jugular in imposing tariffs on the electronics components and so forth that are produced there, because that is a bigger segment of the economy than, say, the agricultural segment, which I think has suffered mostly under the current tariffs, as well as some consumer goods.
Do you have a prediction on how it comes out?
Absolutely no idea. The administration has been unpredictable, and I think China's just kind of waiting to see what he does, and then it's like a kind of a game of chess, right? And he makes a move, and then they kind of figure out how they're going to play defense. But I think they're mostly playing defense, is what it looks like.
Do you, so given some of the concerns around the state of the global economy, and the fact that the bulk of the kind of public equity program is invested internationally, and so on, is there a specific recommendation that you might make regarding that outlook, and given the current positioning of the plan, or is this just a monitoring
type? So maybe if we jump up to slide 25, because that actually is focused on the equity environment. So there was a few questions there. So your portfolio, like many portfolios, is largely growth oriented because of the need to have your assets growing at a rate that will meet or exceed your expected discount rate assumption. And, our long-term view, i.e. 10 years, that's a period we feel comfortable with making a forecast for capital market assumptions or returns. We're looking at U.S. equity returns in the neighborhood of, I think, 6.5%. Not mistaken. We do assign somewhat of a premium to international equity, largely because of the emerging markets, but I think also somewhat in recognition of the currency. So global equities, if you will, somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 to maybe 7.25 is our longer term expectation, and we go through this exercise of revisiting and studying. That's really what Thomas and his group spend a lot of their time on every year. And this year it's probably not going to go up from our expectations that we published last year, because of the fact that we're having so far, at least until July, August, we're having a pretty strong year in the equity market. So whenever there's a very strong year in any capital market, the tendency is to kind of reflect that by decreasing the expected subsequent 10-year expected return for that respective asset class. So, and it's usually modest adjustments, but that's the general approach, because essentially you're pulling forward some of that future return expectation because of the very good year that you just experienced in that asset class. So to the extent that we have a bad year in equities and we're well below our long-term expectation, then we will likely increase, because our expectation is that over long periods of time, markets mean revert, and we will get that sort of level of growth that we expect. That's comprised of basically a couple of components, right? There's a valuation component, and there's a dividend yield component, and then there's a capital appreciation component, which is tied to GDP. So you can almost picture, okay, GDP's, let's say it's roughly 2%, so put 2% on the table for an equity return. Dividend yields are between 2 and 3% typically, and they don't typically change. So you add another 2 to 3%. So you're already at, you know, essentially 5% for an expected return. So then that last component, valuation, is that variable that we see change from year to year. And right now, we would say the equity markets are kind of overvalued, right? And so it depends on when they do correct, how much they correct, or how much the rest of the world changes. So we don't think that there's no recommendation for anything short term, that, you know, we understand that there's risk associated with investing in these markets, and we invest in them because we think over a long period of time we're going to get that, call it 7% return that we need for our portfolios, and over long periods of time that's a reasonable expectation. But you have to take, you know, you just have to kind of take in stride that year in, year out variability in those returns, and some years will be down, some years will be very, very up. Last year was a very up year, double-digit returns. This year could potentially be, you know, flat to slightly negative. So what we've done, what you've done very well, is you've really diversified your portfolio across areas such as private credit and in real estate. So, you know, very cognizant of this large equity risk that you're exposed to, but using these other areas as your anchor to windward, and fixed income, importantly. And importantly, your fixed income portfolio with this liquidity component is very high quality treasuries, which will be the most beneficial asset class during any equity market downturn. So, kind of a long answer, but I think I address.
No, I mean, I think the summary would be your recommendation is to let the long-term capital market process kind of that updating of CMAs mm-hmm. handle that. So no tactical adjustment that I recommend.
Correct. So at least through, on page 25, at least through June, returns were looking pretty good across global markets in context of that long-term expectation. In fact, probably some of them ahead of that. Notably, we do have, in equities, we have two primary drivers of return and risk, and that is style and size. So with respect to the size variable, large cap stocks globally outperformed small cap stocks. And in terms of style, growth stocks outperformed value stocks. And what's interesting about that is, you know, studying markets historically as we have, styles usually change, you know, growth versus value about every 3 to 4 years on average. Historically, they've done that. But right now, we're in this prolonged period of roughly 10 years plus where growth has consistently outperformed value. So, you know, you do have exposure to both of those strategies within your equity portfolio. And what I would say is, as you look at individual managers, and I don't know the extent to which you may do so, you know, keep in mind that their managers are put together to work in tandem. And when you see your value manager producing returns well below the market, understand that it's not really evidence of that manager's skill, but more a function of the fact that we have this particularly anomalous phenomena where value stocks are just really unattractive relative to growth. And growth encompasses, you know, tech, healthcare, probably the two prominent drivers of our economy and the global economy. And value encompasses things like utilities and financial companies. And financial companies are a very big component of our economy as well, something like on the order of 16-17% of our economy. But they have not performed as well since the global financial crisis. So that's the relevance of pointing out that. And then the last market environment comments I'd like to make are on slide 35, and that has to do with currency. And in at least in the second quarter, we have the dollar depreciate relative to most other currencies. And the emerging market currencies were currencies that actually experienced some gains during the quarter. But it's the central bank actions that really contributed to the currency movements that we saw in the second quarter. And Thomas is going to spend quite a bit of time, and hopefully you'll have questions with respect to currency that he'll be able to address at that time. So if there's no more questions about the capital markets, I thought I'd just make some comments about the portfolio under tab 2. Mm-hmm. Is that okay? Okay. So if we turn to slide 4 under tab 2. This just is a comparison of your current actual asset allocation per those asset categories that you bucket sub-asset classes by, compared to the long-term policy. And as you know, you're moving towards your dollar cost averaging into that long-term policy. In fact, at the end of July, there was a rebalance. And so I know Tim will be touching on that in more detail in his report. But you can see, obviously, the very high component that growth comprises of your portfolio. If you then turn to slide 5, the next slide, we look at the performance of the total fund relative to its policy, as well as those three portfolio components. And you can see that the total fund for the quarter did underperform by about 1%, but we'll talk about that more in a moment. But for the year to date, and certainly longer term periods, the portfolio has performed either ahead or in line with its policy. In terms of the growth bucket, that portfolio underperformed its custom benchmark, and again, I will be talking about that more in a moment. But the other two components, diversifying and liquidity, both performed ahead of their respective benchmarks, and that's true for the year-to-date as well as the one-year periods. If you turn to slide 6, which is the next slide, this brings risk into the equation. So clearly, we're taking risk in the portfolio and hopefully earning a commensurate return. And we see both a 3-year and a 5-year snapshot. And what this basically shows is that, here we're comparing you relative to peers on a risk and return basis. And when we compare your fund relative to peers, we see you're slightly lower risk relative to your peers. You're represented by the red square, the CCC ERA fund, but really earning a return that is commensurate with your peers. So that gives you a better, what we call Sharpe ratio, which is a risk-adjusted return relative to your peers. So it doesn't really matter what their respective asset allocations are. It's that ratio, that Sharpe ratio, that we really look at, we think, is the relevant measure to compare yourselves when you're making comparisons relative to peers, because the asset allocations are very different across the various funds.
What is the beta on that page? Beta to what?
So I think that is the beta for the total fund. So that's the policy, the actual exposures relative to the policy exposure. So they should be right on top of each other. There's no meaningful deviations away from your policy.
There's not equity beta. It's beta of the plan to policy benchmark.
I believe it's the plan's policy benchmark. If we were to look at your equity beta, it would also probably be 1 or very close to 1. because you have a healthy dose of index portfolios in your equity portfolios.
The plan level beta?
Yeah, I can double check that for you for next time.
Thank you.
And then if we will turn up then to slide 11. There's a lot of numbers on this page, but really I just want to refer to a couple of them. So here again, we're looking at the total fund relative to the policy and then the three main asset categories, but we also show all of the underlying strategies. I think my main observation is how many of your underlying strategies have really performed well relative to their benchmark, particularly over the quarter and year-to-date period. The glaring exception and the source of that 1% underperformance at the total fund level is the private equity portfolio relative to the benchmark, and you can see that on slide 12, near the bottom of slide 12. And there, as you may be aware, and I don't know how many of you are maybe lower tenured on the board and may not be aware of this, but private equity returns are really, we're looking at them on an internal rate of return comparison. All the returns on this page are time-weighted rates of return. So there is a different calculation methodology that's employed in calculating the returns. In order to make private equity fit so we could calculate your policy, we show you a time-weighted rate of return. But that is, for a quarter, it's essentially a meaningless number. The problem is we also, you know, we have to show all these account returns relative to a benchmark. And the problem with, the second problem related to private equity is benchmarking. There are no good benchmarks or perfect benchmarks for private equity as there are for public equities. So what we have, what we've done here, and many of your peers use the same convention, by the way, is we use a public market benchmark and then we add a premium. It's called a benchmark plus. And in this case, because we had, strong returns, and this is lagged, so it's reflecting the first quarter performance, equity returns were very strong, you see a very big difference between the time-weighted rate of return for private equity and that benchmark. And that is what's being captured in that total fund versus the policy. There are probably other types of benchmark methodologies that we can employ to help us accommodate this. And I think that is something that we would probably like to, in conjunction with staff, bring back to you in terms of, talking about the different types of benchmarking options, the pros and cons, and maybe thinking about whether or not we can narrow some of that, what I call, this is basically misfit risk, where the benchmark really doesn't capture the actual performance of the asset that's being benchmarked against it, but then we also have that added problem of the time-weighted return versus internal rate of return, and there is an approach to deal with that as well.
The lag time still runs 3 to 6 months on private equity? The lag time.
It's three,
six,
yes.
3 to 6 months still?
Yes. Yeah, always.
I just had a question. I wanted to take you back to page 5, or plate 5, the executive summary net of fees. So the policy index, I'm sure I should know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. It's shown in the bottom of the page in a terribly small font.
Yes. Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. I'm kidding. But the question is, this appears to be an historic amalgam of the policy indices, right, by discrete time periods. Am I correct?
Yes, because what we do is we link those respective policy returns together. So it's important to know how that policy has migrated over time.
Right. So what I'm trying to understand is the migration pattern and how we establish the policy index, for instance, from July 1, 2018 to present. How does that happen?
So usually that is a result of an asset allocation exercise. So if you change your asset allocation, that has to be reflected in the policy.
So when we do the investment asset allocation resolutions once a year to reflect the changes, changing size of liquidity program, the board adopts target allocations, provides that to Verus. Verus reflects that in a change, and there are slight changes, but a change in the composition of the policy index at that point in time.
Okay, so the policy index is mirroring
correct
our allocation.
Your implementation. Right,
the target allocation.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It just wasn't clear to me how it was, you know, which comes first and how it was established, because it's the, I mean, our performance against benchmarks is kind of all we really have to go on, right?
Right,
you know,
right.
We have custom benchmarks now, right? We have our simple target, you know, our custom indices that are created because of the nature of the portfolio. So I'm just trying to, I just want to make sure I have some bedrock I'm standing on to understand our performance against either the policy or a benchmark.
Right.
So I just needed to understand that better.
So the policy index that Verus reflects and the simple target index that I reflect in the CIO report both mirror the asset allocation adopted by the board and revised from year to year with slight revisions. And so, you, for example, at the end of June, the board adopted an updated asset allocation.
Right.
That'll be reflected again starting July 1. So when you see the third quarter report in 3 months, it's going to reflect that June board of retirement resolution.
Okay.
So whenever the board adopts it, you know, the first date of the next period reflects that new asset allocation.
Got it. Okay.
I have a question.
If that changes, how how does that affect our like 10-year comparison? If we're making changes over the next 3 months and so forth, but then when we're looking back, and how do you use that?
So the history doesn't change. So it'd be, you know, again, that the reason that footnote is so huge is because we've made these iterative changes from time to time. So it's, you calculate the policy benchmark for, you know, every quarter, and that's kind of locked in time. It reflects the asset allocation in time right then. And it's only changed on a going forward basis. So, you know, you're linking the current asset allocation to all the then current asset allocation targets historically. So it reflects what the target allocation was at any point in that historical record. You're not going back and recalculating that every month or every quarter. You're calculating the then current asset allocation target policy benchmark, lock that down, and you only recalculate that on a going forward basis. Then you link them all together to have a representative policy benchmark for the history.
Okay.
It's less complicated than it sounds.
Yes. Really? Okay.
There'll be a test on this.
Easy peasy.
Do we have a comparison of Sharpe ratios for different? I mean, I think we do for in SACRs in our report, but.
We do, and I will be showing that in a minute or two, or maybe 30, depending on the questions.
I just had a question, ma'am, on your the comment you made on private equity.
Yes.
Because that's not consistent behavior that we've seen, that our private equity bucket has done that to our total fund return for the quarter.
Right.
So can you comment on that?
Yeah, so it's that construct. It's more a function of, because we have to calculate a time-weighted rate of return, and so all of the various private equity investments, we calculated a time-weighted rate of return, and that is not the way to calculate a return for private equity. You really should calculate an internal rate of return, and that internal rate of return should encompass all of the investment periods where the cash flows occurred over for that particular investment. That's not what a time-weighted rate of return reflects. A time-weighted rate of return just reflects at the beginning of the quarter, your market value is this. At the end of the quarter, your market value is this. And the change is what's reflected in the return. It's just not accurate. It's not meaningful. Then the other issue that compounding the impact is it's compared to a public market benchmark that was lagged, and that return was very, very strong for the public markets for that period. So it's not unusual, actually, to see this kind of impact at the total fund level for one quarter, or even a couple of quarters, a very short time horizon. Some ways, I know a couple of clients that I have, the way that they deal with that is they don't calculate a time-weighted rate of return. They just use whatever the actual return was for their portfolio as the policy index return. So for purposes of calculating the total fund return. That's one way to get around that issue. They still keep the benchmark, and they still look at it on an IRR basis, but in order to calculate that total fund return and reduce this aberration from benchmark misfit and the return calculation methodology is just make it, that's the return of the policy is the return of our index, and there's no difference.
This will be...
No, the return of our portfolio, rather. Sorry.
Eileen and I have had discussions around the broader policy of using public benchmarks plus a premium, which are what they're called non-investable. There's no investment that earns, you know, S&P 500 plus 4%. These are statements of expectations that are not investable. They've been a proxy for a lot of programs historically. Private equity has been public markets plus 4%. Private credit has been high yield plus 2%. On an ongoing basis, Eileen's referencing some methodologies that tend to get a tighter fit, and this is something that we want to bring back to the board probably next year in conjunction with the next asset liability study when we take a look at the asset classes we're using and how we might better benchmark them. There are some better options. As you can tell, they get a little complicated. There's a rationale for them, but there'll be some education next year. This perhaps tighten up a fit here. So I don't want the board to get too caught up in that right now.
So maybe to summarize this, the mark to market in our private equity holdings universally really doesn't track particularly well the individual investments.
Exactly.
Ultimately, when they're sold and we determine the internal rate of return on a real basis, we are getting returns that may actually exceed the benchmark, but in the process of what we do for quarterly reporting,
correct,
it doesn't fully capture what's going on.
Exactly.
And that seems very reasonable to me.
Yeah. Did you still have a, you look like you still have a question?
No. We can move on.
Okay.
I'm going to make a comment. I'm having the shifting benchmarks feeling, which is, I usually hate the phrase, we've always done it that way. Everybody in business has encountered that block. But if nothing else, the way we've always done it is at least consistent, so that if we, in the past 10 years, if the private equity benchmark was X plus 4%, whatever, at least when you do time comparative reviews of what your returns were, you're using the same basis, your same benchmark to evaluate that performance over time. Good or bad, at least you were consistent, right? So I'd be a little concerned about changing if we don't have an understanding of why we're changing and how it relates to our evaluation of performance. If we think it's a better benchmark, then so be it. And if that's the case and we adopt it, fine. But we need to understand how it relates to why the one we've had in place for 20 years works, right? And what's wrong with that picture? Because I know you're new to this, but when we came to the different asset allocation, all of us have had varying concerns with the elevator speech, which is how are we able to converse with other trustees and other systems, mm-hmm, to understand how we're doing relative to our peers? Mm-hmm. This is complicated, mm-hmm, right? This is really complicated, and this little granular discussion about this particular benchmark is an example of that. So it's important for us to understand how we're doing in real terms as well as how we think we're doing relative to what our peers report, what the headlines are, and so on. So it matters for that reason, if no other.
Yeah, no, I understand, and I think what you expressed is a common concern of board members. So I think going through the process of looking at different approaches, because there have been newer benchmarks created, as well as new approaches to benchmarking for private markets. And the reason why this has come about now is because you and your peers have gotten that much more invested in private market assets, right? Compared to 10 years ago, most plans were, maybe 0 to 5%. And most plans today, plans that are large public funds such as yourselves, are in the 10 to 20% for having private markets. So the impact on your total fund is much more noticeable today than it was historically, number one. And then number two, there have been a proliferation of new benchmarking approaches as well as new benchmarks. So that those are the kinds of things that we will discuss when we come back to have that discussion on benchmarking.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay. So actually, I just want to refer you quickly to slide 17 and 18, because here are the internal rates of return for your private credit, real estate, and private equity portfolios. We get this information from StepStone so that we can incorporate this data in your total fund results. And so I know that StepStone comes before you annually and can provide you color on the individual investments, but these are the returns for those individual current investments. And with that, I'd like to refer you to slide 27, and this addresses...
Before we go off that section, could you go back to... We didn't cover this page, but just briefly to page 16.
Sure.
Next section. My question relates to some of the stuff that seems to hang around for a while, I guess, and it certainly draws my eye to it periodically. To try and explain, if you look at Carpenter Bank Fund, EIF U.S. Power Fund, and good old Nogales, we may want to set Nogales off as a separate entity. But I'm wondering what conclusions someone can draw, the layperson can draw, when they look at something like Carpenter Fund, not because it's a negative, because it's not, but it's just been hanging around forever, and it looks as if by this you would determine that the market value is zero, which immediately draws some attention. That our capital call has basically, our commitment has basically, remaining commitment is zero. The fund's been around since 2008. Now, there may be something that's hanging out there that needs to be resolved, but I'm wondering if there's a way, or if anybody else is concerned about the possibility of suggesting why those things hang out there as long as they do and appear to be done, for all intents and purposes.
They are done. What's not done is receiving the final audited financial statements. So all the capital has been returned. There's no remaining commitment in the case of Carpenter. But until you get the final audited financial statements, there's a somewhat of reluctance to fully close this. In the case of Carpenter, December 31st, 2019, we will receive the final audited financial statement, close it out. Certainly, we've had discussions with Verus about creating another category of fully realized, mm-hmm. or substantially fully realized, and subdivide those, and I think that does make a lot of sense. There's this balancing act of what's relevant and what's accurate. And now, certainly this is an accurate representation of our financial position today with respect to Carpenter and all the other funds, but certainly some representation of, look, these are the active funds where the price, right. where the market value can move around. These are the ones that are fully realized,
right.
baked. We know what the result is. Plus or minus $1,000.
Yeah, so either a separate category, which is intriguing, or some suggestion that even says that we're awaiting final audited returns you know, to close out the fund, so that if somebody were to focus on this and just look at the zeros, it raises a lot of questions.
Yeah.
It's like, well, did we lose money on this? Did we make money on it? It looks like on that one we made money. That's
yeah,
good.
Looks like we did pretty good. Yeah.
It's a good story.
Yeah.
So, but it's a story that's basically done. We just haven't closed or turned the index on the page. Now, the Nogales falls into a different category. I will fess up to suggesting that I thought we should hang Nogales around for a while, no pun intended. You know, because we should keep it in our forefront so that we could keep in mind that this was not something that worked out well. But this is akin to a public hanging at this point for me. This body's been hanging around for a long time, and I'm wondering if we should bury it.
I believe we've received the final audited financial statement for the final period in the past month.
So
that's how long it takes for it to close out. But I think that's one that we could probably see drop off next.
So we can order the headstone. And so Stepstone knows about the headstone? No, I'm just kidding.
We received the 12/31/18 financial statement that zeroes out everything.
There used to be a saying something along the lines of that's why they do public hangings, but there is a point of diminishing returns on a public hanging.
But certainly, again, a category that everything is fully baked, I think makes sense, regardless of whether it sits there for a period of time or not.
This is a record for mixing metaphors that we've done so far this morning. Just this one item. Okay. All right, thanks. Because it just, the other ones that pop up zero, they're brand new. I mean, there's an easier explanation there. They're new. That's why there's, the capital calls haven't been made yet. If you look at TPG and Trident and whatnot, it's easy to understand why those are zeros. Yeah. But the other ones, it's not quite so easy. Okay, thank you.
Okay. So the last slide I'll be referring to is slide 27, and this is where we do look at the Sharpe ratios relative to peers, to answer the question that was asked earlier. And it's a pretty good story, because if you look at the total fund, which is the circle, it's essentially top quartile, and for the five-year period, it ranks in the sixth decile, or sixth in this universe of peers. And this is the investor metrics public fund database. If you want to compare how you've done relative to peers, you may have a very different asset allocation profile than your peers, but for the risk that you took, you got compensated generally better than your peers. And so when you're making peer comparisons, to me, this is really the only peer comparison you should be making. By comparing just returns, just looking at returns, that is apples to oranges, because asset allocations can be so vastly different. But this is a risk-adjusted return. So it's literally the return minus the cash return divided by the standard deviation that you had on your portfolio. So that ratio is an apples-to-apples comparison to make. And on that comparison across short and long time periods, your fund compares very favorably. So that concludes my formal comments, but again, happy to entertain any additional questions or if any pages that I didn't cover that you want to revisit, I'm happy to do so.
Impact on national debt levels climbing, where do you see that?
Yeah, it's an increasing concern, right? The thing that's interesting to me, though, is if you look at most developed countries, not emerging markets so much, we're all overextended. It's a global phenomena across developed economies. The government certainly is helped by maintaining these very low interest rates, right? Because they have to pay interest payments on the debt that they issue.
Right.
So in some way, that maybe creates a perverse incentive to continue to issue debt. But I think it is increasingly a topic of discussion. And if interest rates do rise, That is going to be, I think, more important consideration because the government will have to try to raise capital to fund that debt and probably won't be able to raise more debt to pay for their debt obligations that they already have. I don't know if you have anything to add on
debt levels, sovereign debt levels, and corporate debt levels have been rising to pretty high levels, but as interest rates come down, that offsets the cost of servicing the debt. So the cost of servicing debt is not out of control. I guess an analogy would be U.S. home prices. U.S. home prices have gone up a lot, especially in places like San Francisco and Seattle, but at the same time, interest rates have come down, so the monthly payment has been more reasonable than if you look at the cost of housing. It's like, wow, it must be really expensive to own a home, but if the 30-year mortgage rate goes to 3%, it's actually not much more expensive, or maybe similarly expensive as past decades to own a home. So that might be another reason why these countries are incentivized not to let interest rates hike up, because if you have a really high debt level and interest rates start to normalize, that could hit national budgets really hard. So it's very possible we're in a low interest rate environment for the next decade or two decades. It could be kind of a new regime that we're in.
Tom, given 30-year bond rates, treasuries, at 2%, the market is saying no big deal. It's completely contrary to how I think, but that seems to me to be what the market is saying. Clearly, it's what the leadership in both our political parties are saying. No big deal.
Germany just issued a 30-year national treasury bond at 0%, and not as many people signed up to buy that bond as they thought. So there might be a limit to how far people will go in accepting a low interest rate. Strange environment.
Anything else for Sequel?
Sorry, I just one wanted to check.
Sure.
Was there any specific strategy that we hold that you had a particular concern around? You had an opportunity to kind of mention if there was something noteworthy. All good?
Yeah, no, I think the only, there's just one strategy that actually is going to be being changed out just because I wondered whether it was a real fit for the category, and it was the Wellington real return strategy within the diversifying bucket. Tim can probably talk more about that, but that strategy will be replaced.
Which one was that?
The Wellington real return.
Wellington.
Yeah. But other than that, no, I think, like I said earlier, I really don't recall ever seeing so many active managers as a group perform as well, at least over the short term, as your managers have done. So I think you've done a good job of picking managers, or staff's done a good job of picking managers.
Great.
I am the top quartile of the firms that you serve. Is it you consult with?
Everybody's
top quartile.
I say all above average.
So generally, from a sharp ratio perspective, which is the way that I think to answer that, I would say at least the clients that I work with now and have historically do rank well there. And I think it's, because of, I think it's Verus, as well as my own philosophy is, diversification. Being thoughtful about active implementation versus passive implementation, keeping costs low because costs really matter in terms of the impact on your returns. I think just adhering to those principles produces the types of results that you see in your portfolio. None of your active managers have wild tracking errors, so you don't have concentrated niche strategies, and that's where I tend to see funds kind of not rank as well on that sharp ratio perspective because they haven't been thoughtful about putting strategies together. They did maybe more of a bottom up portfolio construction as opposed to a top down, and you always have to start from the top down. What is your vision? What are your objectives? And then find the strategies that will all work together to achieve your objectives. And so I think that's what your results reflect.
Okay. Any other questions? Candace, are you good?
Yes, I am fine. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Are you awake?
Okay, thank you. So then we'll move.
So I have you on mute, so that's why there's a little pause delay. It's not the 2,000 miles across the sea. I just don't want to hear. I didn't hear any background noises.
No problem at all. I just wanted to give you a chance to, if you wanted to ask a question.